Welcome to another episode of Fukin Conversation. Today, I'm so lucky to have Tim Stanley, who's at the University of Ottawa, now enjoying retirement, was the former dean of the grad school for the University of Ottawa, vice dean of programs in the Faculty of Ed, and joining us today to talk about his research as a historian and on the history of education, specifically in relation to the different ways in which we might learn from history in relation to addressing racializations, racisms, and exclusions. So, Tim, how you doing?
Not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I'm hanging in here and teaching these two courses, but specifically the one course, research and curriculum studies, where we're doing these different podcasts and looking at different scholars' work. So I'm so excited to have you on here to talk about your research. And I know that you've spent a lot of your career looking at the ways in which we might learn from history in terms of racisms and anti-racisms. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts have been more recently in terms of the 2020 pandemic and the increase in relation to racisms against individuals here in Canada or elsewhere in the United States who are racialized as being Asian or Chinese.
Well, I think I have a number of thoughts about this. Just as sort of before, as a sort of a preliminary comment, one of the mistakes that I think people often make when they talk about these kinds of issues is they assume that somehow this racism is new, or the racism is created by the, for example, by Donald Trump's anti-Chinese statements. And in fact, that's actually a misunderstanding of racism, because the racism is always there because it's deeply embedded in our social organization. And it can become more intense in given contexts, such as the one that we're in right now. I actually think that the danger of anti-Chinese racism is greater than the danger of the virus. And people say, well, you know, I'm a little bit crazy, but really the reason is that this is the kind of thing that can explode in people's faces as if you create the Chinese as scapegoats for our own failures, then it becomes not too far to press to creating tensions that lead to, frankly, World War III. And that will kill tens of millions of people. So I think it's actually the more serious issue of our time.
So it's not something new. And much of your work, what I appreciate is you look at the structure and systemic ways in which racisms occur. And I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the pieces that you sent me. So I they were difficult to get through in terms of my own emotions and affective response to them. So one piece you examine the travesty and tragedy of Colton Bushi. The other one you look at the removal and the ongoing debates of removing monuments former prime ministers like John A. Macdonald. But what I appreciate about your work in relation to looking at these different individuals is how you situate that in relation to the larger structures of settler colonialism and how that's worked to shape the nation we call Canada. So just I think for those that aren't not familiar with your work, it'd be helpful to kind of articulate for us how you're thinking about the processes of racialization and in relation to those structures, and then how different kinds of racisms emerge in relation to that, and then also then how those work in terms of exclusions, and then finally your work in terms of strategic anti-racisms to address those structural exclusions.
Okay, well, let me start at a slightly different endpoint. So, you know, I've been involved in doing anti-racism education in one form or another now for well over 40 years. So I started in the last century and have continued. And I have to say, the thing that struck me during all this time is that the same issues that I was confronting when I was starting in 1979 are still the same issues that we're confronting today. And one of those issues is that many people who are in Canada are actually insulated from the realities of racism that millions of people living in Canada experience on a day-to-day basis. So they think that racism is something unusual or the kind of thing that happens every now and then and for which, you know, we need things like human rights commissions or something like that. Whereas we know from the experiences of people of color, of Indigenous people, of different groups that are racialized other than white, this is something that is actually an everyday part of their reality. And it's something that's either is always at play or always is at risk of coming into play. And what interests me in terms of addressing this is a kind of an educational issue, which I've come in recent years to look on. And this is the idea that we've been going about teaching people about racisms in the wrong way. And somebody who spent his career trying to teach people about racisms, this is quite a revelation. And that's because what we've done is we focused on trying to fix the damaged racist, or we focused on trying to give people who are already aware of racism and concerned about it a deeper understanding of how racism is at work. And it's not to say that those are things that are in and of themselves wrong, but they're not the kinds of things that are going to address the ways in which racisms have gotten structured into literally our landscapes, literally the stuff of our everyday lives, in ways that for most people in Canada is most of the time simply invisible, even if they're living or moving right next to somebody for whom it's all too visible. So those three pieces that I sent you, in some ways, all engage with this kind of reality. So if we just sort of look for a second at like the Colton Bushi piece, which is my most recent piece. And, you know, it was a hard piece to come to write in some ways, in part because, you know, I didn't want to trespass onto the grief of the Bushi family and do them further violence. And who am I to sort of talk about the pain and suffering that they've gone to? But what interests me is the ways in which the killing of Colton Bushi is a product of a whole social structure and political structure based on the exclusion of Indigenous people from what was originally their territories. So the part of Saskatchewan where the killing took place, you have a whole bunch of farmers. This, by the way, includes the members of the Red Pheasant Nation from which Bushi himself comes, which is actually mainly an agricultural community. But you have a bunch of farmers who are of European origins and who see themselves as the people who naturally belong there and see the Indigenous people whose traditional territory it is as aliens, as people who are trespassers who don't belong. And from that, it's easy to then start thinking of those people not only as a group that's different from themselves, but as a group that threatens them, as the people who are responsible for example, crime and so forth in the area. So this becomes a kind of discourse, a kind of way of talking that gets continually reproduced to the point where it becomes kind of a bedrock understanding of people. So these farmers who work hard to make a living look on the land as if, okay, this is ours, we built it. Often they trace themselves back in terms of their own ancestry to people who were given the land for free by the Canadian government. It's an interesting process in itself. And it speaks to me to the ways in which relationships of property are actually based on the transfer of Indigenous people's territories to those of people of European origins. As being built into the country. So this is an example of my sort of larger understanding of how racisms work. And I've argued that racisms are, first of all, multiple. There's more than one kind of racism that's around, and different racisms can be at play at different times and places and in different ways. So, for example, in Canada, anti-Indigenous racism is very much linked to issues of land and who controls it, as we see in the case of the Colton Bushi killings. For example, in Canada, we also have a history of anti-Semitism, of racism directed against people who are of Jewish origins, or more recently, we see it in terms of Islamophobia, for example. And that is those are racisms that have different histories, even if those histories connect together at certain points. So the first idea is that racisms are multiple. There's many of them. A second idea is that all racisms really do three different things. I call them, have to meet three different conditions to be a racism. So the first condition is that they're based on what we call racialization. So racialization is often a difficult concept for people to understand, but it's the social process of making race, of making people believe that there are two groups of people, two or more groups of people, that are different in their essence, and everybody has to fit into one racialized category or the other. This is the kind of stuff that we do constantly when we, for example, talk about group X having Y characteristic, or even when members of the group themselves self-identify as being part of a racialized grouping. So racialization is this social process of making race. So in my historical John A. MacDonald piece, one of the things he says to the House of Commons is the Chinese are aliens, they're aliens in spirit, alien in feeling, and, they can never be British. Well, that's a process of racialization. He's fixing people of Chinese origin as having an essence that's separate from those of European origins. He goes on to say that the Chinese are a mongrel race and that they threaten the Aryan future of British North America, by which he means it's a racially pure dominant composition. So processes of racialization are at work all the time. They're at work even in subtle ways. If we stop to think of it, you can actually have a racialization take place without reference to explicitly racial categories. So let's take a simple sentence like, Canadians love hockey. Well, it's true that many people who call themselves Canadians love hockey. It defines this essential group called Canadians, and implies that all Canadians love hockey. So if you claim to be Canadian and you don't love hockey, you're somehow defective. You're somehow less than. In fact, most people in the world, when they talk about hockey, they talk about field hockey, not ice hockey. But that's not part of that construction. So that very quickly becomes a way of racialization in terms of what Canadians are supposedly do or don't do. So the category itself becomes racialized, often associating with people of European origins, primarily those who speak English and to a lesser extent French as their first and only language, and people who are not immigrants or are not seen as recent immigrants. So the first condition for racisms is this process called racialization. The second thing is that these racializations get organized into exclusions. And I say, or use organization deliberately, because it's things that people have actually made and done. It's not something that just falls from the sky or happens or is natural. And one of the advantages that we have in history is we can actually trace the development of this process of organization. So to go back to the Colton Bushi example, one of the things that really interested me was where did this organization of European property owners and indigenous people who didn't have property come from? And it goes back all the way to Treaty Number 6, when the territory was first sort of normalized in terms of its control by the Canadian government. It explicitly talks about indigenous people having to protect and respect the rights and property of settlers and of Canadian government and the Queen and so forth. But it doesn't talk about settlers having to respect the rights and properties of the so-called Indians at the time. So this literally, this kind of process literally gets made into our landscape. So often we encounter this organization without being aware of the fact that it's been made. It just becomes the way the world is for most of us. So again, in this case of property in Saskatchewan, but I would argue the same thing in terms of property in Ottawa, the fact that people of European origins are the property owners is like not something that even needs explanation. It's just, well, that's just the way the world is. It becomes normal. And what the exclusion does is it actually creates an inclusion. So if one group is being included, another one is, and one group's being excluded, another one's being included. But the final thing for a racism to be a racism is that it has to have what the scholarship calls a non-trivial consequence on the excluded. Well, putting that around, it's got to have an effect on the people who are racialized and excluded that is important. That is important from their own perspectives and from their own understandings and impacts on their lives. And part of the way you determine this is by engaging with what they say about their realities. So one of the problems in racism is that the people who benefit from it, the people who are in the included group, don't actually have to engage with its consequences on the excluded. So from an educational point of view, you can begin anti-racism education by trying to engage with the meanings of excluded people. And then using that as an entry point. So the last thing I want to mention in my framework that I find is I think useful here is that if we understand racisms to be multiple, we understand them to involve racialization, exclusion, and consequence. A friend of mine calls this Tim's wrecking theory of racism, REC. Theory of racism, because it's racism, exclusion, and consequence. This allows us to identify strategies for anti-racism. So anything that opposes a racism is an anti-racism. And just as there's many different racisms, there's many different anti-racisms. But all anti-racisms have within them either the challenging of racialization to point out that actually not everybody in that group allegedly has the same characteristics, that they're different just like everybody else, to challenge exclusions by creating inclusions, to mitigate negative consequences by reducing them. All these are workable strategies. But in the end, what our objective has to be is to end the exclusions that actually are built into our landscape. So that's my long answer to your short question.
Thanks for that, Tim. That was great. Yeah. No, that's great. I think that's really important to outline what I've seen in the work beyond what you sent for us to take a look at was it, in different works that you put forth using examples from history in relation to how we might understand our present lived experiences in terms of those different concepts you put forth. So I appreciate you articulating that. And I wonder to the extent of what took place in relation to Colton Bushi and having kind of a shared last name, but growing up in Montreal, and I'm talking about you growing up in Montreal with the last name like Stanley, but having these kind of multiple genealogies in terms of on the one side, Chinese, and on the other side, correct me if I'm wrong, English, you know, how you know, what were your formative years like in Montreal? And how have you given some thought to how that's shaped the way in which you've approached your work later on as a historian and in relation to history of education? Yeah, have you given that some thought? I know I've asked you this question in the past, and I'm just wondering, you know, how you're thinking about that right now, especially in light of the anti-Chinese racisms that's taking place, Montreal being an epicenter for part of the outbreak, and then also in terms of the passing of Bill 21 and Quebec's ban on religious symbols.
Okay, well, I think I did deal with the last one easiest. I think Bill 21, whatever its motivations or understandings, is fundamentally a racist piece of legislation. It's directed primarily at people who are Muslims, but it also affects Orthodox Jews and other and Sikhs, for example, people who as part of their religious practice, understand their practice as having to include some kind of visible symbols of it. And the effect of this legislation is not actually to create a secular society. It means that people who, for whom this is a very important part of their lives, will become actually more isolated than they were before, and will be cut off from the mainstream of society, as well as we've seen, prohibits people from actually practicing their professions of being who they are in the world. So in some level, I'm quite appalled at the relative silence in the rest of Canada to this piece of legislation. You know, there's a whole discussion we can have about how this comes about in Quebec and, you know, links to sort of understandings in France and so forth. But interestingly enough, one of the things that research in Europe has shown is that, you know, the radical Islamicist extremists and the radical right-wing white racists need each other. They feed on each other, allows each other to build up in a kind of symbiotic relationship. In terms of my own history and sort of how I get into this, you know, I was born, the Montreal I was born and raised in, first of all, I'm English. And I grew up in Montreal at a time when to be English was to, you know, I'd go downtown to Eaton's or something, and the clerk would automatically address me in English. I never had to use French. And in fact, Montreal during my youth was one of the worst places in the world to learn French if you're an Anglophone. Because you were so often working in a world that was English dominated. That's something I think that people today really have trouble understanding. And it's something I think that Quebec has quite rightly moved beyond. But at the time that I was there as a kid, this was a different situation. It was also a highly diverse, multicultural society. I would ride the bus and I would hear people speaking all sorts of languages, mainly European languages. There were relatively few people of color growing up in the area that I was in. And our consciousness of Indigenous people and Indigenous issues was non-existent. Indeed, there's a point at which I was a substitute teacher and I substitute taught at Lachine High School. And it didn't occur to me as anything unusual that the kids who were there from Ganawagi had to leave at 3:30 and couldn't participate in school activities because that's when the bus left to take them. But I was not conscious of even those students, particularly in my classes. So it's just, I just want to mention this. And I thought, I would have said there wasn't any racism in China, at least not in Canada, at least not in a major way, until 1979. And this was after, by the way, I had been an exchange student in China for 2 years. I was doing my master's at UBC in Chinese history during this period. So I was really, I guess, you know, I came back from China, I was 25, so that was 78. So this would have been, I would have been 26, 27. And what changed me was in September of that, of 1979, I saw CTV's public affairs television show, W5, presented a show called The Great Campus Giveaway, which claimed that foreign students were taking away places from, quote, Canadian students at universities. And every time they showed foreigners, they showed Chinese Canadians. And, you know, even down to, like, you know, zeroing in on the blackboard or on a notice board where there's a sign up in Chinese. Of course, I could read the Chinese. It said it was just the Chinese Students Association film night. But, you know, this is all part of this takeover of our institutions by these foreigners. Just to be clear, I'm half Chinese, as you are. Unlike you, I have my father's surname, he's the one who's non-Chinese. So on the Stanley side of the family, we are, I'm like 10th generation Chinese, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, United Empire Loyalist stock, if you please. The Stanleys weren't the fur barons in Montreal. They were their accountants and architects. They also drank a lot and squandered the family fortune, but that's a whole other story. On my mother's side, I'm third generation Chinese Canadian. My mother is born and raised in Montreal, spent all of her life in Montreal. And her parents come from Guangdong in South China. They came in the 19th century. Family tradition has my grandfather entering before 1887 and my grandmother entering, we've documented, in 1893. And my brother and I, we grew up sort of very strongly aware of our Chineseness, and knew we were half Chinese. We would say, like, the left side is the Chinese part and the right side is the WASP part. We debated things like, what's the right racist epithet for us? Is it a combination of, is it CHOSP or is it WINK? So let people figure out where that comes from. And we knew we ate a lot more rice than our friends did. Okay, but I would have said, again, there was no racism in Canada in any significant way until that moment when I saw the W5 show. And I literally shook because I said, they can't talk about my mother that way. Then I realized they weren't talking about my mother. They were talking about me. And I literally shook for 3 days and then got angry and then got involved in anti-racist movements. The fact is that as I was growing up in Montreal, I was surrounded by racism. I knew who was English and who was French before they opened their mouths. I could tell just by the way people moved, by the way they dressed, by what work they did. And that language relationship was racialized until the day that he died. My father would tell you that the French don't know how to drive. How he knew that the person who had just cut him off was French, unless the person rolled down their window and said, you know, maudit anglais, I really don't know. And, you know, even today in Montreal, in parts of the West Island, the English areas, they'll say to people, speak white, meaning speak English. So this is a racialized reality. But I also went to Weger High School in Côte-Saint-Luc, Quebec, which was then part of the third largest Jewish community outside of in the world, second largest outside of in North America, outside of New York City. And although in the Protestant School Board of Greater Montreal, it was a Jewish community. So the school was 97% Jewish in composition. I got all the holidays. And I didn't have to go to synagogue, unlike my Jewish friends. But, you know, my friends would make fun of the ghetto mentality of their parents. But in fact, the reason that Côte-Saint-Luc, Quebec had a large Jewish community was because when the great expansion from the city center to the suburbs came in the 50s and 60s, it was the only suburb that allowed Jews to own land until, I believe, 1963. So this, again, is a created exclusion. And, you know, other things, watch the civil rights movement in the U.S. and Martin Luther King and all that sort of stuff, the move to desegregate schools. The last segregated school for African Canadians in Ontario shut down in 1968. What we know as separate schools were created not just for the religious Catholic or Protestant minority, but were also created for Black Canadians in this province that we're in. I mention this because it's important because it means that I was growing up surrounded by racism. It was part of the air that I breathed. It was in everything that had. It had shaped my parents' relationships in ways I only found out in later years. In fact, much of it I learned after my father had passed away in terms of their relations with his family, for example. It was so part of my life, I didn't see it. It was part of the air I breathed. And I mention this because it's very important, I think, to understand. This is my sort of first insight. And it's an insight that I also saw was reinforced when I got involved in anti-racism stuff in the 1979-1980 in BC. The short answer to your question is the whole biography shapes my approach. Somebody who's mixed race, I don't fit into categories of either or. As somebody who's experienced racism directly, but who passes in their daily life as somebody who is white, I don't experience racism all the time, but I do notice it because of my own experiences and my own study of it. At the same time, I learned in the anti-racist movement in BC that people could be living next door to people who are being subject to racist terror as they're sleep, you know, afraid their homes are going to get attacked in the middle of the night, and be totally unaware of it. And so that shaped my understandings. In terms of the rest of my scholarship, it's like, you know, it starts off with the idea of, well, we need to engage those excluded narratives. So I need to bring in Chinese sources, Chinese language understandings into or the writing of Canadian history. It continues with the idea that racism is an organized thing. So John McDonald history piece traces a moment of its organization into our lives. And it continues as an ongoing thing that we don't see, as seen, for example, in the struggle over commemorating John A. McDonald in Victoria.
Just before I ask you a question about that, I was just going to say that I think that spoke to there, even in terms of thinking about whiteness as being a monolithic category around racialization, so that all white people are the same. I found when we came over to Canada in 75 and shortly thereafter went up to Kapuskasing, I mean, sure, there were the two solitudes, French, English, there was in the curriculum, you know, the definite present absence of the whose traditional territories we were on. And yet there was still also a lot of diversity in the stories that my parents' friends would share about how they came to Canada and immigrated and what were the impacts because of World War II and what were they trying to get away from or survive in these different countries, whether that was in Africa or China, Vietnam, the UK. And we did, you know, I was thinking of Montreal and what you outlined in terms of the different religious backgrounds. In our household, my dad was Protestant, but being a doctor, you believe, you know, agnostic maybe, something bigger out there, but not quite sure, but still a thought, still philosophy in terms of spirituality and Eastern thought. And my mom was Irish, is Irish Catholic, and I was baptized Protestant, but still grew up with my grandfather cheering for the Celtics in Scotland because that was the Irish soccer team, and the Rangers were the Protestant soccer team. And so there was those kind of conversations and divides in our household as well. But still at the same point, not seeing my own racisms that I had until really grad school, and trying to understand how that came to be in relation to my own lived experiences in the school curriculum. And so you speak to this, you know, you make reference to Fazil Rizvi's work on the grammar of racisms, and you talk about the grammar of popular racisms or the banality of everyday racisms. To me, I'm still trying to figure out how to take that up with students or for myself in my own work or even with my own kids. Yeah, so the debates, like even in trying to explain or have that conversation with my three sons about why is it that we would remove a statue or not, and thinking about John A. McDonald being Scottish, and you know the complexity of Scotland's relationship to England, and tracing that history, and then trying to make sense of John A., who's Scottish as well, and then going on to have these conversations about him being the architect behind cultural genocide here in a settler state like Canada. So I just, how do you know, when you take these up or you approach them with students, whether that's in a university classroom or you're working with teachers and students in the schools, how are you approaching these topics?
Okay. I think that a lot of work has been done where you sort of, you know, it comes from the fact that, you know, being a teacher, right, we think that the solution when people are misinformed is to provide correct information. And a lot of anti-racism, as one Australian scholar has noted, has been carried out like it's as if it's part of what we're dealing with is an academic debate. So, you know, the question is, you know, how, you know, you know, if we think we're getting overrun by immigrants, the question becomes, well, how many immigrants are there actually? And it's not as many as you think. I mean, so that somehow is going to solve the problem. So one of the things that comes for me as a historian that I think we need to remember is that all human beings are very complicated. So even John A. McDonald, is a complicated person, even if he's responsible for organizing cultural genocide. As I mentioned in my Victoria piece, it's something that he would actually have been proud of, because what he was doing was he was a British colonizer creating the British Empire. So that's part of what he was devoting himself to. But, you know, he actually had Indigenous First Nations people who were among his correspondents who lived in Ontario, who would be people who, if not his close friends, were certainly acquaintances. Who he saw as people who were worthy people like himself. So he's not a simple racist. It's not just that he's racist against Indigenous people and then therefore he does these horrible things. It's, you know, one of the problems with racism is that the thing that explains the actions, or is it the things that we need to explain itself? Question becomes how he was sort of blinded to some of the realities that he was enforcing, and whether he should have been blind or not, or he was just being willful in his blindness. Those are more interesting questions. So I think it's important to remember that the solution is not simply one of providing correct information in the face of false information. I want to emphasize it's not something we should abandon. Where I've come to in my own thinking is that racism's work, because of what Hannah Arendt once called loneliness, because of the fact that the racists don't have to engage with the human consequences on the excluded of their racism. And as long as that happens, the racisms endure. And even when they have to start engaging, usually what happens is the decks get shuffled a bit, so the racism shifts a little bit in its composition, but the racism itself, the exclusions that it's based on, don't actually disappear. So instead, I think we need to think pedagogically of ways of building connection with people across difference, and doing it in multiple ways, in many different contexts, and in as many different ways as possible. So an example of this kind of thing, to going back to sort of current anti-Chinese racism in Canada, is to understand the ways in which we're connected, for good or for ill, to people in China. So, like, you know, everybody who's a student has a cell phone. You know, 70% of the world's cell phones are constructed in a single factory in Shenzhen in China. And it doesn't matter whether they're iPhones or there are other models and so forth. So whether you think it or not, we actually have material connections in our globalized world to people who are different. Similarly, we have material connections to Indigenous peoples because, frankly, we're sitting on what's their traditional territories, whether we acknowledge it or not. And I think these are the kinds of connections that we need to sort of really focus on pedagogically building. As far as dealing with students are concerned, I've often found it's a different issue who they are. So, you know, in grad studies, the students that I got were mainly ones who took my anti-racism class. And, you know, frankly, they were there. They were already sort of part of the solution, if you want, rather than part of the problem, a little bit. If not entirely speaking to the converted, certainly more so than the average population. Teacher education students are always a greater challenge because they're more representative of the broader spectrum of Canadian society. The challenge is to get people who are privileged by racism to start engaging with the effects, the real living effects on the people who are around them of racism. And I think in the case of teachers or would-be teachers, this is especially an entry point, is the effects on students. And it has to be the effects not on somebody else's students, but on their own students. And that's a tricky thing to get them to engage with. But once people start to realize that we're not talking about the teacher next door, we're talking about the stuff that they themselves do on a daily basis, that creates the possibility of then sort of engaging them in terms of looking at how can you actually change practices to be more effective in building connection.
So, you know, you and I, we went to Wuhan, was it two years ago now? And you've been back to China quite a bit in the last few years. I'm just wondering, you went in the 1970s, and, you know, how things stayed or changed the same, and in relation to the start of this conversation and the larger context and rhetoric and taking up, you know, China and in terms of the blaming narrative of the virus and what's going on, you know, what are your thoughts on based on your trips to there since the 1970s and now thinking back on that in relation to what's going on now?
Well, when I went to China in 1976 and I went on an official Canadian government, Chinese government exchange program, which was formalized when Canada established diplomatic relations with China. And I was in the fourth cohort. So when I went in 1976, there's a couple of things. First, you couldn't go directly to Beijing from anywhere in Canada or Europe, for that matter. You couldn't fly there. We had to fly to Hong Kong, take the train across at Shenzhen, and walk across the border at Shenzhen, a little railroad bridge, and then get another train to Canton, and then from there up to Beijing, and a whole process that took 3 days from Hong Kong. And it was a period in which there were virtually no foreigners in China at all. There were about 300 foreign experts and their families who worked for the Chinese government on things like helping with language polishing for some of their international publications. There were about 10,000 foreign students, mainly from the third world, in different parts of China. And then there were diplomats and their families. So in China, when I went there, this was still a cultural revolution. I arrived in China 10 days before Mao Zedong died and was there when the cultural revolution ends, when the so-called Gang of Four got smashed a month later. And when I left in 1978, China was just starting to reopen to the world. The other thing that China was extremely poor. While I think some wealth had been redistributed and there was all sorts of other issues going on in the country that we could spend hours talking about, it was extremely poor. To give you an example, as a foreign student, my Chinese scholarship and my Canadian scholarship was $100 a month, which was intended to help pay for travel. I had an income that was six times the average worker's wage in China, or in Beijing. So I was rich. So I didn't go back to China until 2014 for a variety of reasons. I went back when I was interim dean of grad studies, in part to go to a meeting with Chinese universities to talk about joint PhD programs. And I spent a couple of weeks traveling around China. And I've since been back, I guess, about five times. And one of the big differences between China then and China now is it's connected to the world. It's part of the world in a way that I still had my head to get around. So when actually airplanes are running internationally, it's, you know, it's now what was a 3-day trip is now a 12-hour flight from Toronto. You can get all sorts of foreign media in China, although reports about China and certain things are censored. You can get things that just would have been impossible to get years before. Generally, China is more open, even as the current regime, its sort of electronic surveillance is actually in some ways worse than the stuff that I had in the 70s. But, and you know, the thing to understand about China is it ain't going to go away. It has a fifth of the world's people, and it's increasingly modernized. The infrastructure that you see in Chinese cities is just amazing. Some of the technology is amongst the most advanced in the world. In small ways and in bigger ways, we get connected to them. So just to give you an example, in the current coronavirus crisis, most of what we know about fighting the virus, about how to contain it, about treatments that work or don't work, and so forth, comes from Chinese experience. They were the first to have it. As a measure of whatever else is the case with China, and there are some problems in terms of the way the Chinese government underreported the virus to its own population, something that didn't surprise any foreign governments, by the way. Whatever else is going on, this is an example of how we're connected. you know, people and things Canadian have always been connected to people and things China since before the existence of this country. You know, European explorers, when they came to Canada, were not looking for Canada. They were looking for a route to the Far East. They were looking to try to go to China. LaSalle, you know, when he went around doing his explorations, brought a formal court robe in, so that if he ran into the Chinese emperor around the next bend of the river, he could be properly attired. That's why his settlement was called Lachine. You know, the great Canadian dream of the transcontinental railroad. The thing that was going to pay for that was the China trade, by providing a direct route between England and Europe and China that went through British territory, you know, especially down to Hong Kong. People have been going back and forth between here and China for the long. The reason we have a West Coast in this country is because the Chinese workers who came on a John Muir's second voyage in 1789 and who built a ship and a fur trading fort that were the things that established the British claim over the Spanish claim to what's now the west coast of Canada. By the way, when Muir's left, those Chinese workers stayed and were the first permanent settlers, even if not really wanting to be settlers, in the west coast of what's today Canada. So this is not new. People of Chinese origin have been in what is now Canada since before it existed. The community currently, as it exists, dates back directly to 1858, which was, and the Fraser River Gold Rush in BC, before the Confederation that became Canada was even being talked about. So, something to think about.
Well, no, and that's what I appreciate about your work, is that you remind Canadians that, you know, there are different stories and different people that were here and elsewhere across what now makes up Canada before, the idea of what we understand, who is Canadian and what makes up Canadian and the work that you do. And so I really appreciate that. And I think more in your recent work, your focus on the very concept of intergenerational equity and the impacts of settler colonialism to maintain its power. And it, you can clearly see in the examples that you provide that, you know, whether it was John A. Macdonald as prime minister or those in local power, that they were all collaborating with each other in different ways. And I'm not saying everyone was, but in different ways to pass legislation that would maintain their power in relation to the racialization of different people. So much so that when I'm, you know, in the 1915, in Ontario, when the Ontario Ministry of Education published its Science of Education Normal School Manual, and under the section for curriculum in that book, so it's 1915, and they republished it in 1919 and 1923, it states, like, the school curriculum, we're told, renders possible an effective control of the experiencing of the child by presenting in a comprehensive form a classified, systematized, and pure representation of the more valuable features of the race experience. So teachers were learning this and being asked to study this in relation to how they may take up, you know, the content that they were teaching in the classroom. So, you know, I really appreciate the way in which you're doing that. And I'm wondering, in terms of your work now, are there any new projects that you're hoping to work on and extend this prior work that you've taken up?
I actually have as my partner sort of teases me, troubles, I have about 5 books in my head that I want to do. And of course, the rate at which they're going is going to take 20 years each. So we'll see where they go.
What's the most, what's the one that you think will give you the most difficulty, but you get most excited about?
The one that gives me the most difficulty that I'm the most excited about is the one that answers this question about what I've come to call the failure of anti-racist education. And that's the idea of rethinking anti-racism. I've got a nice title. It's called Building Connection, Rethinking Anti-Racisms for the 21st Century. And it's an argument about building connection, about tracing from our own local limited space, the ways in which we get connected across time and space to billions, actually tens of billions of other human beings who have lived, you know. Everything, you know, everything that we have in our world, in our human world, is made by other human beings. Whether we're thinking about material things like our, you know, like our houses, the streetscapes, the books, the computers, etc., and human beings who have, you know, built on the work of other humans going back to time to the first human beings who came down from the trees, and that's something important to remind people of and important to trace, and that's a doable project. But we're also connected to everything else. So people say, well, what about air? You know, people didn't make air. Well, increasingly, we are making air. We're making it unbreathable. So we didn't make stars. But we did make the languages, the words, the knowledge systems that allow us to think and understand and to manipulate these things. So there's the material world. There's also the symbolic world. All of this has been made by human beings, by the sum total of human beings who have come before us, of all human action. And then thirdly, this world that we inherit is embodied. So we all embody it in ourselves in ways that that material context and that symbolic context sort of determine the choices that we have in terms of how we experience the world in bodily ways. And so this is also something that's traceable. And, you know, it's traceable around issues of race, around issues of gender, ability, disability, being, you know, cisgendered and so forth. So that's the book that keeps me awake thinking about how I'm going to do it. I also want to do a book on how to teach anti-racism. And I'm actually figuring out how to do that by writing a book right now, or a little book on how to teach Tai Chi Chuan, but that's a whole other story.
Well, Tim, I just wanted to thank you for joining us today on the podcast. I really appreciate it. And we barely scratched the surface in terms of what you take up in your work. And I look forward to having a conversation perhaps in a few months after students and I discuss what you shared, and hope you are open to joining us again on the podcast.
I'd be happy to, and I just want to tell your students that it's not my fault that you're making them read my stuff. So I wish them great success with you and your course.
Okay, thank you.